From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The staggering growth of the Chinese economy makes big headlines these days. Talk of the Chinese century and lost jobs have Americans bracing for a tsunami of economic challenges. Traditional economics suggests that China's gain should be America's gain, too. Our guest this hour is not so sure. Tonight on Point, his charge that American wealth and industry are placing their bets on China and against the future of the U.S. economy. But first, today President Bush nominated John Negroponte to be the nation's first national intelligence director. The 65-year-old career diplomat is currently ambassador to Iraq. In his new position, Negroponte will be the president's principal advisor on intelligence issues and will oversee the country's 15 intelligence agencies. Creating the new position was a central recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. Negroponte must be confirmed by the Senate. David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. He joins me now. David, thanks for being with us tonight.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
How is this this nomination being interpreted? Why John Negroponte?
Well, the president has chosen somebody who has certainly been around the block. He has been in 8 different countries. He's been in every administration, starting as a junior officer in Hong Kong since in the Kennedy administration.
So and then during the Nixon years in Vietnam, he's really been around.
He has really been around. He's also been, and I think this is important to note, a man who's been on the receiving side of some pretty bad intelligence over the years, first in Vietnam, and then as the UN American ambassador to the UN, where he had the unenviable job of having to sell the war in Iraq based on a national intelligence estimate about Iraq's weapons capability that we now know to have been pretty fictional.
So he's had to deal with bad intelligence. How does that make him a candidate to be intelligence director?
Because I think one of the key elements of this job is to try to put together do what the 9/11 Commission and other commissions have called for, put together the 15 agencies of government, members of the intelligence community, in a way that we reduce our vulnerability to such assessments. You'll remember that as we took apart all of the questions about how they came to the conclusions they did on Iraq, in part it was because there really was no great adjudication between dissenting voices in some agencies and the voices that either won the day or were responding to what they believed were the political imperatives of the day.
David Sanger, do we know, was John Negroponte President Bush's first choice for this job?
We think almost certainly he was not. That it was offered at one point to Robert Gates, who's a former CIA director, who's now down at Texas A&M. We think it was either offered or explored with a series of others. Mr. Negroponte, though, has spent 8 months in Iraq, and I guess this is one of the few jobs that can look more pleasant than sitting in the green zone.
And what does it say about the test of wills between Donald Rumsfeld and the Pentagon, which has and wants to have a big role in intelligence, and this position? Is Negroponte going to be able to stand up to Rumsfeld, or is he in agreement that the Pentagon ought to have a big hand on the wheel?
Boy, have you asked the $64,000 question here, because you know, the best sport in Washington, apart from getting good seats when the Nationals arrive here as the new baseball team, is going to be the ringside of watching Ambassador Negroponte, who is a pretty skilled political operator, and Donald Rumsfeld, who's a pretty tough political operator. And Rumsfeld, of course, controls a huge part of the intelligence budget right now, much of it taken up by the Defense Intelligence Agency and other parts of the military. And one of the areas where the legislation that creates a DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, is squishy, is on the question of how much control over budgets this new director will have and how that will work out. And a lot of people would like to be the fly on the wall the first time Secretary Rumsfeld and the new director, assuming he is confirmed, which he almost certainly will be, come to a form of disagreement in the Oval Office.
And finally, David, let me ask you, you know, when John Negroponte was U.N. ambassador, he had to sell the war in Iraq. The intelligence was squishy, but, of course, it was used anyway. Some would say deliberately, in spite of its squishiness. Negroponte's no stranger to
ambitious foreign policy. He was a point man in the Reagan administration, going after the Sandinistas.
That's right.
in Nicaragua. Is he seen as, is he a neoconservative? Is he in tune with Vice President Cheney and a more aggressive foreign policy, even aggressive use of intelligence? Is it clear?
He is certainly conservative, but he's also very much a realist. And almost anybody who's been through the green zone in Iraq in the Bremer time period, when Paul Bremer was running Iraq as basically the American viceroy, and then when Negroponte arrived as the first American ambassador, they'll tell you there was a huge change. He did not come in as the micromanager. He did not come in as somebody who was going to dictate what Iraqi democracy would look like. He came in and said, look, the Iraqis are going to have to figure this out, and it's going to be messy and bloody, but I'm not going to micromanage, essentially saying the way my predecessor did.
An old war horse, maybe a realist, and now with a large amount of power, whether it's decisive, we'll see in that battle with Don Rumsfeld. David Sanger, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Always good to be with you. Take care.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. In every category of major resource but oil, China is now the world's number one consumer. It may also be the biggest threat to America's station as global top dog. Economic competition is nothing new, and America has deep strengths. But now, says my guest tonight, some of the biggest players in the game seem to be changing jerseys. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are shorting the U.S. dollar. American companies are voting with their feet. China's promise looks so magnificent to big U.S. corporations and the super rich, writes journalist Ted Fishman, that U.S. national interest and the long-term health of our economy count little. This hour on Point, Mr. Fishman's charge. Big American money and big American industry are betting on China and undercutting the future of the USA. You can join the conversation tonight. If the smart money is looking to make a mint in China, who's looking out for U.S. interests, for your interests? And does betting on China mean betting against America? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Seattle, Washington, is Ted Fishman, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine and author of the new book, China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. Ted Fishman, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here, Tom. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us again. And we know you've got not just this one thesis. We know you've got a big book out there. And we want to get a deep helping of what you're saying in that book tonight. But you're out today with this kind of in-your-face message, that it's not just a rising economic superpower, but that its rise is being promoted, assisted, and at the expense of the U.S. economy, as I read you, Ted Fishman, by some of the biggest money and biggest corporations in America. Make your case.
Well, it may sound in your face, but in a way it's like back in your face. A couple weeks ago, Bill Gates was addressing, at least this is the press report, that Bill Gates was addressing a small group at the Davos conference in Switzerland. And he was very glad to say that to the assembled that he was short the dollar. And his quote was, "The old dollar's going down."
And this the richest man in the world.
The richest man in the world, you know, and, you know, every investor likes to talk up their position in the world. And Bill Gates' bridge partner is Warren Buffett, and he's been talking down the dollar for 2 years and making a tidy fortune of it. But when these guys make a bet on anything, the rest of the investing world gets behind them. So they have a kind of leverage effect. So if Bill Gates is going to make one fortune on it, the rest of the world is going to make many more fortunes. And these two guys alone could make more on the decline in the dollar than thousands of their own workers could make over their lifetime.
And the decline of the dollar is not just a financial blip, you say. It goes to the core strength of the United States.
Well, we will all benefit if the dollar drifts down because our trade situation needs a lower dollar. But what we will not benefit is if the dollar plummets and loses credibility in the world markets. And when your best businesses, the best corporate titans in your economy, the smartest money talks it down, they're not hoping that the dollar drifts down. They're hoping that the dollar goes way down.
So there's big money talking down the dollar. You're also talking about American corporations voting with their feet, taking business and know-how to China. Isn't that just the economy? How is that voting against the American future? How is that pushing down the American future?
Well, it's all part of the same dynamic. For American corporations, right now there's a kind of war in corporate America over China. The large corporations, the Fortune 500, believe that China is the greatest promise they have in their future. They now do business in mature markets, which are either growing slowly or stagnant. But China is going to have 100 million new middle-class consumers very soon, so they can get a big boost in their growth and, in fact, hope for all their marginal growth over the near future to come from the Chinese market.
Why isn't that good for the United States?
Well, it's good for the United States, all things being equal. But, Tom, all things are not equal because with the tide of capital that brings the Fortune 500 to China comes the demand that they make a commitment to the Chinese economy, which moves manufacturing over there. Now, for us, the Fortune 500 companies, which look like industrial companies, are also the destinations for the products of tens of thousands of American companies that make products that go into the things the Fortune 500 sell. So if you look at a cell phone, it has maybe 200 products. If you look at a car, it has 20,000 components. If you look at a Boeing airplane, it has hundreds of thousands of things. And these are made by the group of companies that is the core of American business.
Or at least they have been.
80% of the economy. Yeah, they have been, right.
So this is the hollowing out argument that now goes to China and U.S. companies are basically taking it there.
Right.
Ted Fishman, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight with Ted Fishman, author of the new book, China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World, talking about American industry and American wealth placing their bets on China and against the future of the U.S. economy. Do you buy it? If the smart money is sure it can make a mint in China, who's looking out for U.S. interests, for your interests? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American industry and American wealth placing their bets on China and against the future of the U.S. economy. That's the charge of my guest tonight, Ted Fishman. He's a former currency trader on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He's author of the new book, China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. What do you think of this premise? Are U.S. money and industry acknowledging China's dynamism or fueling it at America's expense? If Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are shorting the dollar, are they driving it down or just being realists? And when jobs and money can go anywhere and do, who's looking out for America's interests? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll hear pushback in this hour from an economist who doesn't buy Ted Fishman's take on things. And we want to get more of that, Ted, but I wish you'd step back with us for a minute first and give us the big picture. You've described some of it to us in previous visits here. But remind us, you say that for the first time in history, American economic supremacy is now under fire. Paint the picture of that.
Well, as you know, Tom, what's happening in China is unprecedented in the history of the world. There are 300 million Chinese people who live very poor lives, who are picking themselves up from the farm and finding themselves into a new urbanized China.
That's 300 million out of 1.3 billion total population.
Right, or maybe more. Mm-hmm. And, China already has 140 cities of a million people, and it is building something like a Philadelphia or a Houston every month.
They have 140 cities of a million. The U.S. has how many of that size of more than a million?
The U.S. has 9. Europe has 32.
China has 140 already. Okay.
Yeah.
That's just cities,
and
though. So what? Okay.
That's just cities, And, some of these came out of nowhere, like Shenzhen didn't even exist 12 years ago, basically. But
down
now
by Hong Kong.
Manhattan.
Right.
Now it's bigger than New York.
Bigger than Manhattan. Okay.
What's happening is that you are getting a huge supply of labor into a huge new agglomeration of factories. This is creating two things. It's creating consumers with more money than Chinese ever had before, but it's also creating Goliath industrial zones, which can produce goods vastly cheaper than anything American manufacturers can produce. And this is a double whammy that is almost, this is candy to the world's multinational corporations who love the idea of all those consumers and love the idea of making things for less money. And that's not necessarily all bad. Of course, because as consumers, we benefit in the United States. We love to have lower priced goods. But on the other hand, we also wear the hat of workers. and workers are very nervous. And one of the things I did in China Inc. was go around China and talk to hundreds of people who are living this miracle. But I also went around the United States, Germany, and Japan and talked to people who are having to respond to this miracle.
Let's look at the China side for a second.
Sure. Describe
for us, if you can, your sense of China. We're speaking collectively here, but the Chinese ambition. How did the Chinese, or how does China see itself in 50 years? 100 years?
Well, of course, the Chinese miracle is peppered with all kinds of hope, but that hope is also empirical, because as China rises, it will almost inevitably be the world's largest economy. You know, China only needs a per capita income less than a quarter of the American per capita income in order to have the world's largest economy. So the people of China only have to be as rich as the people of the middle economies of Africa in order for China to have the largest economic footprint in the entire world. And as you said in your introduction, in commodities, it's already being felt.
And this is something entirely new. You say that if the per capita income in China were to double overnight, the size of China's economy would instantly top the U.S. economy, but it would still be a very poor country. Per capita income still only at the level of Botswana. Now, this is something we haven't seen before, an economy of that scale with that kind of poverty at the same time.
That's right. So a country that is that much in demand of the world's resources, but also that capable of producing goods at vastly lower prices than higher wage economies. And that is something entirely new.
Do the Chinese see themselves dominating the world economy in this century?
Yeah. I don't think anybody in China who is involved in this doubts it. For one reason is they've had 20 years of remarkable growth, 9.5% on average, or something around 9% over the last 20 years. Anyone who's a mutual fund investor knows what kind of compounding you would get if you had that kind of return. It'd be phenomenal. Well, the Chinese have lived it. Their per capita income has gone up fourfold in 20 years.
Okay, now let's go back to American captains of big money and captains of industry. First, on the industry side, we know a lot of American companies are moving jobs and work to China. This is a process we're fairly familiar with. It's been going on for decades to different countries. What is qualitatively different about it, and why do you say that they're not just following, you know, a kind of economic dictate, they're actually exporting America's future? Why? How?
Well, what happens when American companies go into China and make the deal to go into China is, first of all, they come with a tide of capital. And along with that tide of capital comes a tide of expertise, which is demanded by the Chinese, and it's demanded that it be shared. So things that we normally would think of as proprietary, like high-end technology, management expertise, things that companies here keep within their own ranks, are forced to be shared within the Chinese economy.
The U.S. would never export those to a smaller economy, Singapore or Taiwan, but China is so big that they're willing to give up the technology to get into the market.
We've exported it, but not as a gift. To China, it goes as a gift. If you look at the United States, which is a knowledge economy where businesses have a high expense to pay for the knowledge ware and the technology that they use, that very same technology goes to China for virtually no cost. There is almost no technology cost in Chinese manufacturing.
Because it's being given to them, you're saying, by first world companies, by multinationals, by American companies.
By American companies, also by American higher education, institutions of higher education who are setting up schools over there, technical arrangements, business schools, all are in the business of providing business expertise to the Chinese over there. You know, there's virtually no one at the top tier of American industry who isn't betting on China. It also, what is different about China is that while the U.S. has spread its expertise around the world before, it has never done so without a fee to be paid. You know, China, because of the great lure of its domestic market, can insist that technology move there and get shared.
Now, why doesn't all this just speed up the kind of win-win that's supposed to come with globalization? If China just becomes a bigger market quicker, why doesn't that just speed the kind of mutual benefits that economists assume would be implicit here?
Well, you have to think about what it does to the best that our economy can offer. Right now, we exist in a knowledge economy, and we are willing to allow the low-end manufacturing to go abroad. But because the knowledge economy is a knowledge economy that exists in the head, that exists on paper, that exists in bits and bytes, it can be transferred extremely easily overseas. So not only does technology get transferred on the tide of capital, it just gets transferred with the click of a mouse, with email. And so you have this double whammy against the United States, which is our best corporations bringing the best technology, which is developed in our universities with government grants, with our best dollars, with our best talent, which is educated at great expense to the public, along with this huge tide of pirated and counterfeit technology that goes over there. And the end result is a replica economy of the United States planted inside China.
Now, let's look at the capital side. Again, you've got Warren Buffett's been very public about his position on the dollar. He's shorting it. You say Bill Gates is saying the same thing at Davos. The old dollar is going down. The dollar's status as a reserve currency has been huge for the United States. Are you saying that these richest Americans are betting against that reserve currency status with everything that might imply?
Well, if we lose the reserve currency status, then anyone who speculates against the dollar has an enormous windfall, because the dollar would be in free fall. It wouldn't just be drifting down as an adjustment to trade. We would lose this great safety net that's been under our currency for a very long time.
And if the dollar were not the sort of universal currency, what are the implications for the U.S. economy?
Well, the reason why it's very important for us to have the reserve currency is it makes the dollar the port, you could say the currency port, that the rest of the world wants to park its economic ship in. Indeed, the Chinese lend us about $1 billion a day and in buying U.S. bonds. It also means that a lot of the dollars out in the world just never return to the United States, which acts as an enormous loan to our economy. And if that loan comes due, then we will become a debtor nation. You know, we will find the peonage that the economies of Latin America have been suffering under, and because of it are further behind today than they were in 1980.
So let me be sure I've got the bottom line that you're putting out there. You're saying that U.S. big U.S. money and big U.S. industry are not only betting against betting on China and against the United States, but they're kind of undercutting the U.S. economic future.
Yeah, I mean, we should be clear that there's two different rivers running here. You know, one is the river of speculative money, which is willing to see the United States just lose its bearing as a reserve currency. And the other is the shift of technology and industry that's going over there in order to capture a share of the Chinese market and the bargains that are being made in order to do that.
But it's a big kind of scary charge that you're making. We want to test it for a minute here. Ted Fishman, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Philadelphia, Jeremy Siegel. He's professor of finance at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, author of Stock for the Long Run and Revolution on Wall Street. Jeremy Siegel, welcome back to One Point. Good to have you.
Happy to be here.
So Ted Fishman is making the case that big American capital and big American corporations are betting on China, are betting against the U.S., and are undercutting the U.S. future in the process. As an economist, how do you see that, Jeremy Siegel?
Well, I do know that Warren Buffett has written, he's pessimistic about the dollar, and he got his friend Bill Gates to also be pessimistic about the dollar.
Right.
I'm not anywhere near that pessimistic about the dollar. I think there's a tremendous development in China, India, and the rest of the world, and they're going to want U.S. assets, not just U.S. dollars for reserves, but they want some of our capital. And, my feeling is that China really is buying U.S. government bonds, not so much just to have a reserve currency, but they want to make inroads into the United States. The United States is the best customer for them, and they may know that they're buying, expensive government bonds,
right,
but they want to continue that. And I don't see any – the Chinese government has no intention right now of revaluing the yuan, and I think that they're going to continue that for quite a while.
So let me ask you then, explain this to us. If the richest Americans that there are, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, if they bet against the dollar – I mean, shorting the dollar, that's what it is – could they spark a run on the dollar? Could they drive the dollar down to a ruinous level where it would no longer be the world's reserve currency? Does China's buying of U.S. bonds offset that somehow? Could these guys not spark the run that would be ruinous for this country?
Well, as rich as they are, I guess number one and number two, they still don't have as many bonds as the Bank of Japan or the Bank of China. So, no, those two can't do it. I mean, I think Mr. Fishman worries that, you know, everyone will start getting rid of the dollar, which I don't think is going to happen. Because actually, as much as the dollar has fallen over the last 2 years, it fell an awful lot more in the 70s and early 80s. And in fact, even today at its level, it is above where it was 10 years ago. So, you know, yeah, we've had a lot of fluctuations with the dollar. The dollar has always been a magnet. You know, capital is formed here. Mm-hmm. Businesses are formed here. And, yes, the world can get bigger. And I would imagine the, you know, euros are going to start to be accumulated, but I don't think it's going to be anything precipitous at all.
All right. Ted Fishman, respond on this one. Jeremy Siegel saying, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, big as they are, can bet all day against the dollar. And as long as the Bank of Japan and the Bank of China hang in there with it, it's not going to collapse. And so it's not such a problem.
Well, I would like to ask a Professor Siegel a question, if I may.
Sure.
Is the dollar lower now, I mean higher now than it was 10 years ago against the basket of European currencies that now make up the euro?
Actually, the answer to that is yes, slightly. I've reconstructed the euro before 99, and it was constituted as a new currency in 99. And actually, where it is today is above where it was in 95, 94. I mean, I don't remember exactly what year it is, but we are not lower than we were against the lows. We had tremendous appreciation, as you know, of the dollar between 1997 and 2001, 2002, early 2002, where people were calling it overvalued.
But Ted, let me ask you, if I may, the core argument here is that China is not going to let this party stop because it wants the U.S. as a market. It's going to keep investing in U.S. bonds. That supports the dollar, so it's okay. Do you doubt that, Ted?
Well, I don't think investing in U.S. bonds is a dollar purchase. It's a dollar expense, first of all. That's the way you sell dollars. One thing that Professor Siegel probably knows far better than I do, which is the leveraged nature of currency speculation, which is whatever wealth Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and the people who follow them devote to speculating against the dollar, it is made in a leverage format which multiplies it by 10 at least. And this is an enormous tide of money that can course through the currency markets. And currency markets are very emotional. No matter what efficient market theorists say in the long run where currencies ought to be, the markets are very emotional. It can do very extreme damage in the short run. And all we need to do is get to this psychological barrier where people no longer think the dollar is safe as a reserve currency.
I think we've got the arguments there. Jeremy Siegel, let's turn to American corporations for a moment. Ted Fishman says they're not just moving jobs to China and investing in China. They're giving core American technology to China in a way that's turbocharging its economy at the expense of the U.S. economy. Loser for the U.S.
Well, my big view is that China is a big winner for the U.S. You know, we talk about Walmart, and there's a lot of strong feelings on either side. But the cheap products, and a lot of them do come from China, are helping really the lower middle class, lower class and middle class the most. It's keeping inflation down on the good side. It is a lifesaver for many families that they can buy at those prices. And it actually stretches our income that we can use for other expenditures.
But does it hollow out the U.S. economy to the point where there is no good economy left?
Well, you know, to me, I think if the rest of the world gets richer, that's good for the whole world. I mean, look at, you know, Europe is a very rich area. Probably per capita income is nearly the same as us. Have they hollowed us out? No,
but they don't have 300 million, you know, super low-income residents willing to work in factories for a fraction of American workers.
Right. Well, the interesting thing was, you know, 20 years ago they were working for 20 cents an hour. Now they're demanding 80 or 90 cents an hour. You know, when we take a look at the big sweep over here, if we take a look, for instance, 1980, where we were just about balanced trade to now, where we're way in deficit, there's no question. I'm not going to argue that point. But the interesting fact is over that 20-year period, as much as we complain about jobs, the U.S. has gained more jobs than all the rest of the developed countries, Europe and Japan, put together.
And you don't think China is any different? It's not a new dynamic.
And it's, I don't think that that is a new dynamic. Sure, they challenge a few of them. Actually, if you want to know the truth, I think India, on information technology, is more of a is a little bit more of a challenge to what people thought was, you know, our comparative advantage.
Our core bread and butter there.
Now, China is moving in that direction. I mean, you know, there's no question. But actually, India, the radiologists there, the computer programmers there.
We got it. Jeremy Siegel, we got to take a break. And I know I have to let you go, but grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thanks for keeping us thinking here.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Ted Fishman, stand by. We're talking about China tonight and what kind of threat it is, may be, to the USA. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about captains of American industry and American wealth placing their bets on China and against, my guest tonight says, against the future of the U.S. economy. We're talking tonight with Ted Fishman. He is former currency trader on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, a contributing editor to Harper's and author of the new book, China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. You are very welcome to join this conversation. What do you think? If the smart money is sure it can make a mint in China, who's looking out for you, U.S. interests, for your interests? Will the rush of jobs and investment to China be a wake-up call to the U.S.? If the profits are bigger in China, whose job is it to make sure business gets done in America? And does this all sound like paranoia to you? Is the U.S. economy too big to fail? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul is calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Paul.
What I wanted to bring up is that because I have I work in a business in Worcester and I have a lot of experience in China competing with the Chinese and with a venture partner over there.
Okay.
It's one of the fascinating pieces that I see as a small piece of the pie here is that it's not the labor low wages that bother U.S. manufacturers, particularly the high capital intensive industries like we are.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that over 60% of the industrial debt in China is now in default. And I'm competing against people over there who essentially don't have to recoup their capital investment.
In other words, the cost of their capital is something like free.
It's free because what the government looks at and the government banks look at is it's the price of privatizing the population. And I understand the politics of that. But what they're doing in Walmart and the General Electrics and so on have raised this to a high art form. They go from vendor to vendor over there. They get factories built. They use them until they can find somebody who's willing to undercut the cost of goods in the next factory. And it just goes on and on. It's a fascinating piece to watch when you look at the prices and you understand the raw material cost is far in excess of the goods you've got in your hand. You realize that some people aren't getting paid.
It's like 0% financing.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Right.
I've tried to talk banks in Worcester into that.
They're not buying it. Paul, stick with us for a second. I want to hear Ted Fishman on that. Ted, here Paul is competing with Chinese companies. He says it's not the wages. It's the essentially nearly free capital that his competitors are running on.
Well, I really welcome Paul's comments. They are right on the money. It's not just 0% financing. It's free money. There's a difference between having to pay no interest and just getting a gift. And what the Chinese banks, the government-controlled banks, often do with Chinese industry is they simply lend the money with no expectation of getting it back.
And why? How can that go on?
Well, it can go on because in China, and this is one of the things that a free market argument could never address, there are so many crisscrossing conflicts of interest in China in which the government is doing business as a manufacturer, as a buyer, as the employer, that it's impossible to drive a wedge between that relationship and separate out what is the real cost of business.
Paul,
and often the cost of business is so low that American manufacturers can't compete.
Paul, let me ask you about the fundamental premise that Ted Fishman's putting out tonight, that in effect, U.S. big business and money is not just betting on China, but they're kind of betting against the U.S., even undercutting the American economy. You're in biz. You deal with China. Do you see that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the game that Walmart wants to play, and I guess is saying they have to play, is to get goods at the lowest cost they can no matter what. And the fact that they're playing in a playground where the rules are skewed against what we would call normal capitalist economics, it doesn't matter to them. They just need to do it, and they've raised it to a high art form. If I go to the National Association of Manufacturers and talk to them as a small manufacturer, I realize that most of the dues are being paid by the big guys who want the price to go down. Mm-hmm. Now, when Ford moves an engine over there of, let's say, this is an actual case, in my industry, they move an engine over there, an 8-cylinder engine that's going to be a 10 or 12-year engine.
Right.
That's a multi-billion dollar, $25,000 employee a year movement of jobs from the U.S. economy to the Chinese economy.
Do you see how that can end up as a win-win for the U.S.?
Oh, it can, but in the sense of this particular instance, nothing's being paid for in the real terms that we would expect the capital to be paid for.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is that engine plant never exists anymore, and the next engine after the particular one that goes over there by default.
Of course, because that's where the manufacturing is. Paul, we appreciate your call tonight, and good luck in your business. Thanks very much for being with us. I want to get another call here. Curtis is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Curtis. You're on the air.
It's a very fascinating show. I really appreciate it. I spent some time in China over the last couple of years, and
mm-hmm.
I think we're talking here about some really interesting things, but I think we're talking about a Faustian bargain in the long run for those who put all their money in China. And what I'm talking about is the fact that while you have tremendous profits and you can work with the people there working at 80 or 90 cents per hour, when you travel from the south to the north, and I've gone all the way to the Russian border, you find tens and tens and tens of millions of people who simply are living on these farms at $200, $250 a year, who are very unhappy.
Right.
And they're moving to the city in numbers that China can't really control. And the problem they have is when they get there, 60% of the population has no water pollution treatment. The air is, you can't even breathe.
Yep.
The resources are limited, and they can't even produce hardly enough food. The future of China, when we met with the Chinese Academy, they're so scared of what's going to happen. We were up on near the Russian border, and there were just literally tens of thousands of acres of corn sitting in the field. No one could harvest. No labor. Nobody wanted to do it. And so they're scared to death. So a tiny little area of China with 300-400 million people,
mm-hmm.
which is more than the U.S., is producing all this goods, but the rest of the country is suffering terribly.
Curtis, stick with us for a second. Ted Fishman, what about this argument that China, you can put money in China, but it's risky. It's a big risk. It could blow up. It's not sustainable, Curtis says.
True enough that any investment in any economy is risky, and China has its share of risks right now. The banking system, if it keeps lending money out for no cost, is a huge risk. But, you know, one feature of the United States economy is that when other economies collapse, it puts more pressure on U.S. industry. So it works both ways. When the Asian contagion hurts the Southeast Asian economies, goods out of those countries were even cheaper. There was all the more reason to chase that cheap labor.
So you don't see that being a break on American capital, American investment in China, the fear of political instability there?
That's
more than just
vast
economic
instability,
collapse.
Of course. Yeah, vast instability. One reason China's attractive is because it's far more stable than its neighbors. But if there's an economic collapse without a political collapse, then we benefit.
Well, far more stable than Russia, true, and North Korea, but more stable than South Korea, Japan.
No, South Korea and Japan, of course, are higher wage economies now, but more stable than China's direct competitors for low wage labor like Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam.
Mm. Curtis, what about that notion that even if their economy went belly up, it's still a good deal for U.S. manufacturers because wages just get lower, the factories are still there, they just start it up again?
Well, I think you can make a dollar, as I said, but the problem is I think long-term stability of China worries me because you have a million peasants sitting there literally with no money, and I think it's the story, the boat has to rise for everyone. It just can't be a small group, and you've got people in the cities making $1,500 a year and the people on the farms making $250 and being taxed $50 on their farms, and we were in these tiny villages, and that's all they talked about was why were they being taxed $50
right.
on their farms?
On their puny incomes.
Yeah, maybe we could talk about this from another angle, too, which
yes.
is why does the Chinese government see it in its interest not to follow certain norms of international business that we would like,
such as
intellectual property protection, right? Well, mm-hmm. one reason is because it sees the transfer of technology like American software, 90 80% or more of which is used in China, is used illegally, just copied and used.
Pirated.
Pirated. If you can just gift to your people, to your billion people, wealth from another country and technology from another country, what do you do as the leader of those billion people? Do you say, I'm not going to give you that wealth? Or do you say, look, this is our one shot to take it and make my country richer? Well, I think the Chinese leadership sees this as the way to make their country richer. And not following these norms is a kind of industrial policy for them. It's a kind of subsidy to their interest. And you might be able to think of it as the world's largest industrial subsidy.
Of course, peasants outside Harbin are not going to be eating software. So there remains that chance of political instability that Curtis talks about. But Ted Fishman, you say the big money could just surf that, just ride that out. Interesting. Let's get another call here. Paz is calling from Abington, Massachusetts. Hi, Paz. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I feel like the last two comments from Paul and Curtis have really been very deep and awesome, and I feel like my question is very superficial at this point.
We'll take it, Paz. What are you thinking? What are you asking?
I was just going to ask if companies like Walmart and the technology companies that are investing in these other countries really have a choice. I mean, if the long-term proposition is that they either stay here and do business with more expensive labor and more expensive resources, or if they want to compete with the rest of the world, they have to go out and get the cheaper resources. What's your thoughts on that?
So there's you wonder if there's any way out of this kind of cycle.
Yeah, will they survive if they don't do this? And by extension, will our economy do worse if we don't? If our companies don't do that now?
Ted Fishman.
Well, first of all, I must really disagree with the caller. The question is not superficial. It's a very deep question. It's a very deep question and a good one. You know, now I've lost the train of it.
Walmart, does it have any choice?
Oh, right.
In a way,
right.
Does our entire economy have any choice but engaging deeply with China?
Right. Well, one of the features of our economic model is that companies do compete with each other, so that as long as one company is going to China, it forces the rest. This is why we need a comprehensive approach to how we're going to deal with the rise of China. And right now, we are so divided, as your earlier caller said, that even the National Association of Manufacturers doesn't know where it stands on these issues. We're so divided as a country without a comprehensive approach to how to deal with it, that is part of the dynamic that forces companies to China.
But a comprehensive approach, I mean, America, we've never been like Japan with the kind of Ministry of International Trade, you know, being the master puppeteer. That's never been done here.
It's interesting. In some ways, we are exactly like Japan. I mean, if you look at our pharmaceutical industry, you know, the Japanese pay more for Japanese products than anybody else in the world. You know, who pays more for American drugs than anyone else in the world?
Okay, in a couple of categories, but not right across the economy. But let's say the country did get very – recognize the threat as Ted Fishman defines it and got very organized in response. What would that organization in response look like, Ted?
Well, one would be let's take the issue of technology transfer, for example. If companies like Walmart are profiting by doing business with Chinese companies that take technology for free, when that technology returns to the United States in the form of goods, perhaps there ought to be a tariff on that good which is made with pirated technology, so that it eliminates the incentive to take it.
So if they don't pay up front, they pay on the back end.
That's right.
Okay, so there's one. What would that be enough, or what else?
Well, that we ought to make it not quite so easy for American corporations to organize the transfer of their technology over there. You know, if you take a computer scientist in the United States and match him against somebody in China who is quite well skilled himself, you know, the person in China may make a tenth of the wage of the computer scientist in the United States. But there's a good chance that he was also trained by an American with a research and development lab in China. But for us, that gives away the greatest treasure that we have. These are our workers who are paid with the top dollar of our economy from, you know, often at dear expense to our philanthropies, our educational institutions, and our government. We can't just allow it to be given away so easily.
But in both these instances, you're talking about kind of tightening the screws on the flow of information. Is that possible in this day and age?
We're going to have to think about whether it's possible and whether we want it. You know, right now we have such a free market religion that we're not even thinking about China the way we need to think about it, because we think of it as an analog to the United States. It is not an analog to the United States. It's a completely different creature. It's an authoritarian, large economy with a largely poor population, and we've never faced anything like that before.
You quote Bill Gates praising it as, quote, a brand new form of capitalism, but one that strikes more fear than admiration in you, Ted.
Well, that is one of the most chilling things I've ever heard, and I hesitate when I say it, but it really sounds to me like Lindbergh praising the Nazis in the 1930s. You know, he thought they had it all figured out, and here it is, our leading industrialist who has an army of workers paid for with the best by the best American universities and parents pouring money into their own families. And here he is praising the economy, which is about to give us a big run on our money.
Standing in Davos, Switzerland, and doing just that. Pause. Thanks for your call. Dick is calling from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks much. Great show. An assessment, and it deals with whither hence the financial institution network.
In China?
China finally sets up.
The ones we're hearing about giving away all this money.
Right. It strikes me as we look down the century that whither hence China, you know, it's got a lot going for it, everything your guests are saying.
Mm.
But will it be able ultimately to sustain, to develop, to sustain, to regulate a financial system that's as squared away, as honest, as deeply... solid as ours is. I think that's going to be a huge question mark.
A big question, because you can't defy gravity and sort of play games forever. Dick, our time is short, but thanks for the call. Ted Fishman, what about that point?
I agree with the caller. One thing I want to really stress is I'm not rooting against the Chinese people. I hope they do succeed, and I want to mirror Professor Siegel's, you know, sentiment that we can prosper and they can prosper. But this is a new problem, and it requires a very important, high-level, comprehensive discussion among everybody. And so far, we are not getting it because our constituencies are too divided on it. And that is the nature of our problem. Hopefully it's where the genius for a solution will come to. We won't face a challenge to our economy and standard of living that is like China. This is it. This is the big issue for us for a generation or more.
I guess what caught my attention here is that, you know, this is a case where you wouldn't mind seeing just a little more nationalism. When capital and manufacturing get so internationalized, it seems that maybe there's no concern among.
Can you imagine a Japanese Can you imagine a Japanese industrialist saying what Bill Gates said about his country? I mean, I don't think there's a business person from any other country in the world who would say that.
But we expect the American Chamber of Commerce to, at some level, rally behind American education, American technology, American future. And you're suggesting, Ted, that they may never. They may just become Chinese pashas sitting on all kinds of wealth made there.
Well, below the Fortune 500 is a huge groundswell of complaint about what the bigger companies in this country are doing, and that's going to force a political solution to this issue. And right now, the China lobby in this country is the Fortune 500, and I don't think that's going to stay that way.
It may change. This may become a more visceral political issue. We'll be watching out for that. You inform us for the debate ahead. Ted Fishman, always great talking with you. Thanks for the new book, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Ted Fishman, author of China, Inc., How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Rachel Dornhelm, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Michael Garth, Angel Cazelli, Leslie Mormira, and Tim Skog, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.